So I'm going to offer. So this for those. Oh, yo, there is in terms of the sign-up sheet. I think maybe everyone got the email. Maybe not everybody got the email. So had this notion to do the 2 weeks on the Four Noble Truths, which is what the Buddha first taught, and it's right at the core of what the tradition is. And also, Sims is going to have a year-long thing on the Four Noble Truths. So I don't go. Each side doesn't go in lockstep with what Sims does, but seemed like it'd be nice to sort of parallel a little bit, and it's just such a wonderful area. So hang on a second, get this to come up. I'm always torn about having these things. Now, if I was one of the monastics, who is literally part of Ajahn Chah tradition. To never write down a talk. And I can't do that. I'm amazed. Dalai Lama is incredible. I've been teaching the Dalai Lama. He does this incredibly brilliant thing and he ends it exactly when it was supposed to end. I don't know how he does that. But these guys are pretty amazing too, the Clear Mountain. But I tend to write things down, but I just use it to start from. So. But it's really wonderful to talk about the Four Noble Truths and to explore those together. Because that is the absolute, that's like the absolute, on one level, it's the absolute bedrock of what the Buddha taught. And no matter what tradition y'all might be in, or anybody might be in, whether it's Zen or Vajrayana or Theravada or anything, the Four Noble Truths underlies it. And also, there's a way in which if we could totally awaken to what is in the Four Noble Truths, we'd awaken right there. I mean, even though it's the fact that it's a core teaching doesn't mean it's like a simple basic teaching. It is the teaching. So it really is a doorway, the doorway in a way. So I'm going to start off in a funny way of doing it though, because I want to suggest that our natural state of being when we're not being tugged by grasping and confusion and patterns is happiness. That's who we are as sentient beings. You know, it's only because of conditions and how we are with those conditions that we struggle. So our default is happiness. And if we could, any one of us could suddenly peel off all those conditionings and identities and everything, we'd be awakened. But it's not so easy, obviously, because it's lifetimes and lifetimes, perhaps, of conditioning, not to mention this very gnarly lifetime that many of us have had. So that's why we practice. It's a journey. And I've had the opportunity to be around some quite highly realized beings, the Dalai Lama, some of the Ajahns in Thailand, and over the years, a whole bunch of folks. And there's a sense of a simplicity. You really see there's a sense of a simplicity in these people that they're just being their natural selves and there's nothing in the way. And for us, we got all kind of stuff in the way, you know? But that's just stuff. So it's wonderful to think about these Four Noble Truths from that perspective to me. Because the First Noble Truth, which is in English, often translated as the truth of suffering, can seem difficult to people. Like, really? That's a fun thing? I want to go there to something that's their first noble truth? That can seem like off-putting. So I'm trying to reframe it to help us look at it in a different way. Because a way of waiting, the first noble truth is that conditioning takes us away from our natural state and brings suffering. But it's not that life is inherently suffering. It's that how we are right now, so far, brings suffering. And the so far means we don't have to be that way. That's why we practice. That's why there is a path to get away from, to get beyond that conditioning that makes life hard. And the second noble truth is that clinging or identification, that's what takes us away from our natural state. And that's why things are hard. That's why we suffer, even though that's a funny word. So we'll get into that. Robert Thurman, he talks about, he has the same sense of things, and he talks about unawakened life is suffering. Unawakened life is suffering, with a parallel that awakened life is not suffering, or dare we say, it's happy or contented. I was really struck again in Thailand, Ajahn Gunha. He was something else, and he was so. It's hard to describe. He had this ebullient radiance. He just kept reaching out to people and he'd like pull you up and lift you up. And he just made all these people feel special. It just never, the whole time I was there, it was just like constant. One of the senior monks said he's always that way. I've never seen him do anything for himself. He's always looking for how he can help pull people ahead into their own possibility. So I kind of bring it up this way because when people, they read about the Dharma, they hear teachings that life is suffering, they think, oh, these like bummer Buddhists, they think that somehow life is unhappy and they're downers and I think I'll go somewhere else, and that doesn't relate to how I look at life, because people, there's good things about life, right? And also they hear the Buddha, he teaches over and over, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. And they hear the first part and they don't hear the second part. But the second part was really what he's teaching, but he's also helping us see where we start from. Suffering and the end of suffering. And you could say that the unique contribution of the Buddha is that what he first talked about, the nature of things, is like the concrete, realistic starting point of how our lives are. There's no leap of faith required. We just start where you are, and that's really, there's kind of a rugged honesty that comes up in the Dharma, and people like start where they are and then work with that. So the first half that we're talking about tonight, the fact of dukkha or suffering and the reason for it is sort of naming the situation. The second half, which we'll be talking about next time, is what we do about it. That's the third and fourth noble truth. But this time we're talking about the unsatisfactory of awakened existence and the reason why. So I want to back up a little bit about the importance of the Four Noble Truths, because they're so central, and some of this, like I said, they were in all of the different traditions, and they were the very first thing that the Buddha taught to the five ascetics at Sarnath. To decode that a little bit, some of you may know, Buddha awakened in what is now India. He awakened in Bodh Gaya, which is in what is now Bihar, which is along the Ganges Valley. And after he awakened, he won't go into the whole thing, but there was this dialogue about whether people could even understand what he had to teach. But he decided to teach. His first impulse was to teach the two teachers who had brought him to a certain level before he went ahead of them and attained Buddhahood. But then when he turned his mind outward, or maybe it was a Deva told him anyway, they both just died. So that didn't work. So he went to teach the five ascetics who he had worked with in his earlier years as a young wandering ascetic himself. And I mean, just to get, it's a great story because there was no internet then, 2,600 years ago. So he just, in his mind's eye, he saw where they were. They were in Sarnath, just outside of Varanasi. Varanasi is the ancient holy city in India on the Ganges. So he walked for 150 miles to get there. And when he showed up, he says in the suttas that the ascetics had been, they thought he was, because he'd started eating. That was part of, he almost died from complete asceticism. He was so skinny that he talks, it's great stuff. I won't get into it, but he talks about how emaciated he was and just falling over, and he couldn't even stand up because he'd fall over. He was so emaciated, so he started eating. And they thought he was now a glutton. So they said, oh, here comes Buddha the glutton. We're not going to talk to him. But then when he started getting closer, he was so radiant. In spite of themselves, they stood up and said, oh my God, what happened to you? And then he shared the Dharma with them. And he shared in the first teaching, which I cannot pronounce very well, but it's called the Dhamma Kakapavatana Sutta. But it's the very first teaching that he gave in Sarnath. There's a stupa where he taught it, or the remains of a stupa anyway. And he carried these four noble truths together for his entire 40 years of teaching. And it's kind of amazing when you think about it that he had awakened and he saw the framework of what he's going to teach right out of the blocks. It wasn't like he kind of had a few ideas and then kind of developed it in coming years. He just like, boom. He exactly taught exactly what the root was right then, and then kept doing that. But this is where he, in a sense, that first sutta is where he really just makes it super clear. It's really beautiful, completely cooked. So, suffering. What kind of translation is that anyway? The Pali word is dukkha. It's a much better word to use because it's a Pali word, and you can not get hung up in the Western connotations. And it removes, you know, suffering has so many connotations and meanings in English that it muddies the water. Often, dukkha is translated as unsatisfactoriness, which is a clumsy mouthful, but it does get closer to what it means. So that's a good option. So, part of where people have trouble getting their heads around this is, you know, to varying degrees, and I heard different things when people were checking in. So, you know, life isn't all roses and cream or cherries and cream or whatever, something with cream for everybody. Obviously, people are going through some different stuff. But at the same time, we're lucky. I mean, also, we're lucky here in the Northwest. We're lucky in the United States. We're not in a war zone. If human beings just get a chance to live their lives, it's pretty okay. There's nature, there's friendship, there's warmth, you know, the human circumstance in the periods when it goes okay is pretty nice. It's not actually, doesn't seem like it's suffering. And so that's beautiful, and not to negate that, but it's more around the realities of even that, you know, how much can we depend on that? Because if we start looking more closely, you know, in our culture, people sort of hold at arm's length little questions like death, for instance. You know, it's sort of buried in our culture. You know, I remember when I was at a wat in Thailand many years ago, and at the front of the altar, on one hand was a human skeleton hanging there, and on the other hand was a fetus in a bottle that had been preserved, which you probably couldn't do in this country, but they did there. But it really made you think, you know, kind of the realities of life also, even though things are pretty pleasant. And I remember, I don't know, it's, you know, it's funny. I remember it really stuck in my head. One time I was in Seattle because I used to work in downtown. This was like this time of year, early in the morning, 7:30 in the morning, just going to work. Somehow down, and this woman got out of a bus and was walking to work, and it was like hissing down rain, freezing cold, dark, the whole deal. And she had a lei around her neck, like she just got off the flight from Hawaii, and now she had to go back to work. And somehow it really struck me as like, oh man, that stuff ends, you know? The nicest thing you can create, it's not permanent. It's a nice thing, but it's not permanent. You can't depend on it. So have the nice thing and also understand how it is. You can't depend on it. And that's kind of how it is. That's kind of how life is. Even Jeff Bezos, you know, with all of his money and giant boat and giant situations that he's created for himself, all super blessed, he's going to die. It's not going to be forever. He won't be able to stop that from happening, or any ridiculously wealthy person. So we all have these same conditions around even our happy times. And to be able to really work with that in a way that we're no longer beholden by conditions, that we can find a deeper sense of peace in life, irrespective of those. That's where this practice takes us. So we're no longer a victim of conditions, but we can roll with them. And I know a number of people here, I won't call out names, but have had some hard things in recent years. And because of the Dharma, they've been able to just get through it, fully feeling the pain, but not getting stuck in the suffering as much as most people would. Pretty profound levels of that. So this is where this takes us. Because, you know, in our culture, we try to make really nice conditions. And it's funny reading the Seattle Times. There's like a whole section about all kind of really nice food, and then there's a whole section about all kind of really nice stuff you can do to your houses, and it's just all kind of really nice stuff. And it can change in a nanosecond. It's the nature of accidents. We don't plan them. It can just change, or we can get a sudden diagnosis, all that kind of stuff. There was a story, I think I said this last time, but I read about it just recently again. Story of the New York Times about this extremely wealthy couple in the Hamptons. Did anybody see that story? And you saw that? Yeah, it was so interesting.
Yes.
Crazy wealthy couple, so it seemed. And he had inherited this real estate empire, and somehow it just didn't work out so well. But they kept this ridiculous level of lifestyle where they were like, jetting to Italy and had this huge mansion and all this stuff. And he was actually going down financially, didn't even tell his wife. And she had a whole like online presence with like 80,000 followers where she was talking about their incredibly glamorous life that they had. And he eventually like had a big insurance policy, went out in his garage when they were in Italy and started up his Porsche and died in the garage, killed himself, because he just couldn't like reboot that their conditions were different. So we're, in some ways, we're a little bit like that, all of us. Well, to some degree, I am. We try to hold on to the nice stuff and kind of keep the not nice stuff from happening, but to be present with it is part of what the Buddha's teaching. To not be blindsided or confused or resistant to the fact that things will change, and then be able to be present with it and not have it take us down. So there's external circumstances, they change, and then internal circumstances, conditions. I mean, everybody's got, most people got kind of inner demons that they're working with, stuff from their conditioning, their traumas, past lifetimes, who knows? But all that stuff in it, and it conditions us, it keeps us from just being like, just to be present and just be happy. Because we can't actually do that. People do that. It's all within our realm of possibility, but all our stuff gets in the way to varying degrees at varying times. So that's also part of the journey, the outer and the inner conditions and how much those add up to unsatisfactoriness or dukkha. And I'm not even talking about, I mean, if we lived in Haiti or the Sudan or Ukraine or Myanmar or North Korea, or if we were Muslim in Western China, or the list goes on, where it'd be really, really painful. And maybe, and we probably would suffer, but maybe there'd be an option not to, even in the middle of that ridiculousness. I was talking to someone just recently from the Sangha who's Cuban, and he just went back to Cuba. He went to Cuba because he found as a Sangha group in Havana, and he felt moved to go work with them. And things are pretty gnarly in Cuba. I mean, it kind of, everything's rationed. Not everything. It's hard. It's in some ways it's a culture that's together. In another way, it's really hard. And he was struck in the middle of that because of their Dharma practice, how they fed this visiting nun, and there was a lot of beautiful heart there. So it's kind of that whole arena of, circumstance and how painful it is, and how we work with the suffering aspect of it that this is about. And that's a distinction that's critical in here. Okay, Dan, take care. He's got a Dan's logging out. Between pain and suffering. Between pain and suffering. It's really worth exploring that distinction because they're not the same. We can experience pain. That doesn't mean we have to suffer. Pain is just a bunch of sensations. It might be emotional, it might be physical, whatever it is. Suffering, they say pain happens, suffering is optional. I mean, it's a little flip because you got to do a lot of work for it to be optional. But nonetheless, I've met many people and known many people who, despite pain, found ways through their practice to find equanimity also. And the pain situation became not defining. Like people in the samsaric world, they're just often they're just suffering. If they're in pain, they're just suffering in the end of the story, and it's horrible and it sucks and why me? But when people practice, it becomes very different, and it's just what's happening right now. And the practice is what you do with it. So to really, you know, I suggest, it's funny, this, I have a new computer, and it does this weird thing where it's panning around. I can't quite figure that out. That's strange. It's something to really look at in your practice, you know, in terms of this question of Four Noble Truths, the first one, the difference between pain and suffering, and to really look at that in terms of how you feel about things and how you experience that and what you can do to work with it, because they're really different. And the direction that the Buddha is taking us is that not suffering doesn't depend on circumstance. Not suffering is internal. Not suffering is how we grow. Circumstance happens, but not suffering, not dukkha, that's how we grow. And sometimes, you know, and I say this with love, because I do a lot of interfaith stuff and I have a lot of connections with all kinds of people in different traditions, but sometimes I can see that people in some traditions, when they pray, they're trying to get the outer circumstances to be better. They pray for things to work out. They pray for, you know, I mean, to varying degrees. But there is some of that. And I know several people who have had crises of faith because it didn't work out. I mean, they were in just really, really gnarly situations. Nothing changed. And they thought it would get better, and it didn't. And so they had to do something else, but they didn't know how to do anything else, because it was really posited on, if you have faith, things will be okay, and they weren't okay. So this is, to me, this part of why I'm in this tradition. This makes sense to me. You know, it's like, how are we in our hearts and minds and view to be okay even when things aren't okay? Because praying doesn't always work. Sometimes it does. Who knows? I don't understand. So what the Buddha taught is whatever the circumstance is, we don't have to suffer. And through the progress on the path, we can reach a place of equanimity. Even happiness has nothing to do with conditions. It's kind of ultimate freedom. And you don't have to be afraid of what's going to change and like things will go wrong and then my life will be a train wreck. It actually doesn't matter how we are inside. And I've been, you know, I talk about this a lot, because I know I've talked about this, but the Buddha's life was actually pretty rough outwardly. The outward conditions of the Buddha's life were fairly gnarly. Both of his closest mentors, both kings, were taken, their own sons. They had coup d'etats. In both cases, sons took them over, killed their dads. And during the Buddha's lifetime, one of them, Bimbisara's prison, was right near, I've been there, right near the bamboo grove and right near Vulture Peak. So the Buddha may have well been going by while his friend King Bimbisara was starving to death there. His own cousin was constantly trying to, Devadatta, trying to kill the Buddha, tried several times. His own family, during his lifetime, was overrun, and both of his brothers were killed because they were kind of a minor little kinglet in the part of a bigger kingdom. So That's a lot of stuff, right? I mean, that's pretty, just like us, just like life was his life. It wasn't somehow all special and radiant in terms of outward circumstances, but when you're reading the suttas, that's 40 years of teachings, he was doing all that in the middle of all that. He was manifesting his awakenedness to people while all this stuff was happening. It's pretty amazing. That he did that, but it really shows in a very profound way that he did experience pain, and even talks about it a few times. When Moggallana dies, one of his two chief disciples, he expresses pain about him dying. And there are a number of circumstances where the Buddha, had physical situations. He had back pain, he had headaches, he had stone splinters in his feet. There's different allusions to him having physical pain. And all of it, while it was there, recognized, didn't lead to suffering. And so the radiance of what he taught continued that whole time. And to me, that's like inspiring, basically. Like, oh, I want to do that, right? I want to do that. So that's kind of why we do this, a certain way of looking at it. And, you know, when you start to read about other highly realized beings, this same pattern comes up a lot. I mean, there's some great Ramana Maharshi, my first teacher, Genla Rinpa, the 16th Karmapa, and Ramakrishna all died of cancer. And in all cases, it was really painful. Ramakrishna had a big tumor in his neck. Ramana Maharshi had some kind of tumor in his arm. Genla had a stomach cancer. Genla was like, they took him to a hospital, and he said, once they realized they couldn't do anything, they wanted to like give him pain relief. And he said, no, I'm out of here. He went back and practiced through it and died. He was not going to be in a hospital. He wanted to be awake, and it was okay. You know, so these great beings, they just navigate this in extraordinary ways. Watching the clock here. And, you know, traditionally it's taught to three kinds of suffering. The suffering of suffering, which has to do with when pain happens and we suffer because of that, physical pain. Suffering of change, which means stuff we want to keep with us goes away. Stuff we don't want comes to us. Suffering of change. And then the suffering kind of like of conditional existence in a much broader way. Those three kinds of sufferings that are in the suttas talked about all the time. So I just love this about the Dharma, because the Buddha didn't make stuff up. He just pointed it out. It's already there, you know. This is like kind of self-evident in a way. He just pointed it out. So the second question is, you know, the cause of suffering, second noble truth, why do we suffer? And if we understand that, then we can move into the third and fourth, how do we get out of it? How do we get it to stop? And here's what the Buddha said in his first talk. He said, now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. It is this craving which leads to renewed existence accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there, that is, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, craving for extermination. So a key word is craving, repeated four times in this one long sentence. And the Pali word is tanha, which is translated as thirst. So I sometimes think that's because when you know the Pali word, it works a lot better. And thirst is, you know, it's one of these things we experience, and it seems like when we have thirst or extreme thirst, we feel like we need to satiate it. Which, if we actually need water, we do. But having that as the word for craving, it's how people get with the stuff that they crave. They feel like they need to satiate it, and people will be driven to do that, driven so that they're not in equanimity or peace, because there's thirst. And it kind of clarifies what this whole suffering issue is about, because it's about thirsting for something that we want, thirsting for or aversion, wishing something would go away that happened that we don't want. But it's this very existential quality that we tend to get stuck in. And it's interesting, there's also this word delight repeated twice in there. It's arama in Pali. And the point is, there's nothing essentially problematic in delighting. It's just the delighting isn't the problem. You know, delighting, I mean, you could pat a kitten or something, some nice thing, you know, smell a flower, that's fine. The problem is when we get stuck. That's when it's a problem. Because then the tanha happens. So it's good to like, it doesn't, you know, it again gets back to this very thing about, is this a kind of a downer tradition? Well, it's not. We can smell flowers and be happy and pat kittens and eat an ice cream. You know, Dalai Lama is very cute as hell about things like ice cream. He's just very happy about it, and then he totally lets it go. And he's not looking for more ice cream to be contented. He just was happy about, delighted in that ice cream, but not stuck. And that's kind of how we can learn to navigate with that delighting thing. But the tanha part, that's what takes us out. And it's a clue about why this is such a problem. The very last words of the first noble truth, which I didn't read, but it does say the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. And some of you know the five aggregates. They're the five skandhas. They make up our sense of self, body, vedanas, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. It's that list of things that we create our sense of self around. And if those aggregates want stuff that they cling. It gets into our very sense of self that wants. And that is suffering, you know? That very sense, I want, and you feel it in your bones and you identify with it, I want, that's suffering. And in that, when you start to look into what that means, it's all about me and I and grasping and wanting. So it's interesting sometimes when you know, if any of us have known people with addiction problems or been around that world, people tend to isolate off in feeding their addiction. It separates them from others. You know, they kind of pull into themselves. They want the experience themselves. They don't want the badness of withdrawal, and they get really isolated and cut off. And people who are struggling with that kind of addiction, the sense of I is super strong. They're trying to feed that I. But we're all, until we're a Buddha, I always think we have some of those aspects, every single one of us, until we're a Buddha. You know, some grasping of I around stuff we want, or pushing away that which we don't want. And we can really see how the concretization of I, the grasping, is a lot of what causes suffering. It's a lot of what causes suffering. Whereas this Ajahn Ganha, there was a way in which he had this amazing delight in things, but he didn't stick there. It was really amazing to watch. He just kept rolling out energy for others. He didn't stick there. I couldn't find the eye, kind of. And so delighting's not bad, but the grasping, that's the part. That's the part where it messes us up. So you could say no selfing, no craving, and no craving, no suffering. That might be a formula for how this practice works and what the problem is, and maybe the solution we'll be talking about, you know, next time. And then one, you know, I'm almost done here, but just to also touch on this area we're talking about, how do I say it? It reflects the brilliance of the four foundations of mindfulness, which is where the Buddha taught us how to meditate, and in particular, the second foundation, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, which seems like, I remember when I first encountered it, I was like, what? What's that about? It doesn't seem like much of anything, but actually it's so pivotal. It's right in this area that we're looking at right now, because, you know, if there's unpleasant, if we can be mindful of that right in the middle of it being unpleasant, just that's unpleasantness, then we don't have tanha in the same way. We're being mindful of it. We're kind of slipping the clutch on it. It doesn't grab us in the same way, and the same with unpleasant. So it really shows how powerful that mindfulness practice we do is in working with the very cause of suffering question. Because the more we can be mindful of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, the less tanha grabs us. And it also, mindfulness also lessens selfing or self-identification, which also helps, you know, free us. It's amazing how the path kind of comes at things from different directions and they all complement each other. It's pretty amazing. So, you know, I'm almost done, but this all suggests that dukkha, suffering, is really not about circumstance, it's really about attitude, or it's really about our view, what we see. Pain's about circumstance, suffering is not, ultimately. Easier said than done, but nonetheless, that's where the path is going. And so many of us know, I mean, there's people in this very circle, I'll let them name themselves as they want, but so many people here have done astonishing things with painful circumstance and brought it onto the path. And so it's not like, you know, it's this sort of fantasy that, oh, maybe someday you can become a Buddha. So actually it works. It works in life, day by day. So suffering's not inherent in life. It's not inherent in, let me try this again. Suffering is inherent in unawakened life, but it's not inherent in life. If we can awaken, we can be free of it. Then the more we awaken, the freer we are. So it's actually not a gloomy tradition at all. It's kind of woohoo. The possibilities are astonishing. So the second two steps, third and fourth troops, third and fourth noble truths, using the metaphor of a physician, a doctor, these first two were like identifying the problem and naming kind of a diagnosis. The third one is the possibility of a cure, and the fourth is how to be cured. So we'll explore those next time. Let me sit for a moment.